This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week, a former finance minister from Australia tells us that the media's turning politics into a sideshow and dumbing down democracy there. But is that just the media's fault? And is what he's warning about over there already happening over here? We also look at a so-called slur that stirred up some in the media last week, but didn't seem to shake others so much. But first, we look at the media response to developments in the story that derailed the career of an aspiring MP.
It was left to 3IC David Cunliffe to talk, albeit reluctantly.
I think he's got some time now to chart his course and certainly welcome him back at some time.
But whether Hughes had to leave at all is the question that will now be haunting Gough and Labor.
That was TV3 political reporter Rebecca Wright on 3 News last Thursday, reporting on speculation about a political comeback for former MP Darren Hughes, now that the police have said he won't face charges as a result of a complaint made about him in early March. And it's not only his Labour Party which might be haunted now by that question of whether he should have gone in the first place, because the media too was part of the reason he went. Not that you'd know that from many of the reports of this week's developments. In late March, his downfall was the first big political story to break after the big quake in Christchurch 1 month earlier. And as we heard on this program at the time, TV news bulletins and several papers quickly labelled the story a sex scandal, yet they didn't say precisely what the scandalous behaviour was, or even if they knew what it was, but couldn't say. Back then, commentators were queuing up to say that Darren Hughes should have resigned immediately or that his leader should have dumped him. And some claimed that many people knew what Darren did, such as Matthew Hooton speaking on Radio New Zealand National's 9 to Noon.
This was all round town, right. And the idea it could be kept secret when judges and police and warrants are involved, you know,
it's extraordinary. There's a final question, isn't
it? But if that was the case, it was pretty odd that no journalist reported the alleged incident until 3 weeks after it took place. Indeed, some senior journalists made it clear they didn't know any details, such as broadcaster Sean Plunkett, who said this in his newspaper column at the time.
Just what is alleged, we don't actually know.
What journalists had really be doing, Sean Plunkett said back then, was joining the dots and making a salacious picture. Now, interestingly, this week's police statement also included this comment.
Some media outlets received an anonymous letter about Mr. Hughes whilst police were investigating this complaint. I can confirm those allegations contained in the letter have been investigated, and there were no matters which arose that required police attention.
Even though it seems there's no case for Darren Hughes to answer now, some in the media are still saying that Labour leader Phil Gough should have got rid of Darren Hughes or accepted his resignation a lot earlier than he did. And on Wednesday, the Dominion Post's political editor, Tracy Watkins, wrote that the questions about Phil Gough's leadership remain, along with what she called
a mile-wide chip on the shoulders of some within Parliament over the way the story played out in the media.
And prominent among them was Labour's Trevor Mallard, who said this the same day.
I think there might be some journalists who might like to examine what they did.
But this week, few in the media have addressed their role in the way the Darren Hughes story has played out so far. Take, for instance, the daily News Talk ZB political report posted on the broadcaster's website last Thursday morning. In it, Katie Bradford-Crozier made this point.
Given that his colleague Shane Jones' career survived by a thread after he was found to have watched porn paid by the taxpayer, it would have been extremely difficult for Mr. Hughes to sit in the debating chamber while police carried out a 13-week investigation.
Though quite what one situation had to do with the other wasn't made clear, and she then wound up that report last Thursday morning with this conclusion.
The best thing for him to do now is to try and regain his life by starting a new career, having a life outside Parliament and the crazy world of politics. And it'll be up to the voters to then decide if the sins of the past can be forgiven.
However, shortly after that, on the same morning, on the same radio station, presenter Mike Hosking clearly didn't see it that way in his on-air editorial for the day.
Hughes, by all accounts, is a liked, a very capable politician of high standing and a big future, and that's gone. That got wrecked in the carnage of the smoke that swirled and that mad frenzy when the allegations flew like confetti. If only we could be calm about these things, if only those who needed to could keep their cool and take a deep breath.
Now, when Mike Hosking referred there to we who ought to keep calm about these things, he didn't explicitly say who he was referring to, and he wasn't specific either about the source of what he called the mad frenzy. But Darren Hughes himself was, in his statement this week in response to the police announcement. He said it was the frenzied media attention that left him with no choice but to resign from Parliament. Well, Vernon Small is the Deputy Bureau Chief in the Parliamentary Press Gallery for Fairfax Media, and as such, the author of many stories about Darren Hughes over recent weeks. So this week I asked Vernon Small if Darren Hughes was right that the media had made it impossible for him to stay in Parliament.
I've seen a few media frenzies in my time, and this didn't feel like one to me, and I think my colleagues share that view.
I mean, there was an awful lot of comment, though, basically saying that this guy's position is untenable, and voices saying, well, hang on a minute, let's see what's revealed in an investigation, were not nearly as prominent, if not almost entirely absent.
Oh, maybe, but I think from our point of view, you know, as political reporters, the attention was overwhelmingly on Phil Gough's handling of it and its effect on the Labour Party. I mean, I've just looked back through the files since you sort of first contacted me, and I stick to that view. Even the editorial commentary was very much about, did Phil Gough handle this well? And reflecting back on it, of course, he'd known for a couple of weeks and kept it secret, hadn't said anything. And then over the space of 3 days, he moved from a position of putting Mr. Hughes on leave, then taking away his portfolios, and then finally accepting the resignation, which he had been offered earlier by Mr. Hughes and hadn't accepted.
But, I mean, isn't that almost the same thing, Vernon, if you have a lot of people saying, well, because of the Labour Party leader's handling, it's untenable for him. If the media keeps saying that, that does make it impossible to have taken a stance of, I'm going to tough this out until an investigation reveals results. I mean, in a way, it's that weight of media pressure, of people saying that and the public believing it, that arguably forced Phil Gough to act.
Well, I think the weight of media commentary was that had Phil Gough stood him down, said that there's been an accusation against Mr. Hughes right at the start and he's stepping aside, that the focus wouldn't have been so much on Phil Gough's handling of it, and maybe it wouldn't have got the same legs. I mean, I know one commentator this week said it would have been a one-cycle wonder. I don't believe it ever would have been that, because the media would have still been interested in getting the facts out about what happened and talking to the parties. But I don't think if your suggestion is we should just ignore it and keep the public in the dark, I don't think we'd ever do that.
Does anyone feel that, given that the outcome has been that no charges will be laid here, that delaying, standing by him, not acting, was in fact a kind of fairly honourable course?
Well, that's certainly Mr. Gough's view, and personally it may have been honourable, but we were looking at the politics of it, and the politics were disastrous in my view, that you keep something secret, and then when you're first approached by the media, you just won't even comment on whether the thing is true or not, and then you have to have three fallback positions before you finally accept a resignation. That's something that the press gallery and political reporters will always comment on.
Right, so you would argue that if a police investigation took an awfully long time, then there would actually be public pressure on the media saying, hey, why have 12 weeks gone by and you've told us nothing?
Yeah, and remember when we broke the story, we didn't name Mr. Hughes or the complainant. We just said that there was a senior Labour MP, and it was Mr. Hughes who named himself.
Your colleague Tracy Watkins said that some in Labour have a mile-wide chip on their shoulders about the way this has played out in the media. And Trevor Mallard said journalists, or is reported as saying, journalists should examine what they did. I mean, have you identified any reporting that you thought was unethical, inappropriate in the reporting of the story?
No, I don't think so. And I wasn't at the press conference, but my colleagues tell me that Mr. Mallard actually said something along the lines of not people in this room. So presumably that meant the press gallery. So no, I'm not aware of anything. I'm aware of complaints and I'm aware of sorts of things that Labour were objecting to, but nothing concrete, no.
But has it prompted any navel gazing in the gallery among yourselves and your colleagues, thinking, well, if the question's now being posed, did Darren Hughes have to resign in the first place, which has come up in a couple of reports this week, have people in the gallery not thought, well, possibly, but for us reporting the story while the investigation was open, it could have been something that he could have written out?
No, I think, as I said before, I think the weight of opinion is that the survival of Mr. Hughes as a politician was more down to the way the whole thing was handled by the Labour Party and by Phil Gough, rather than the fact that we reveal to the public something they've got a right to know. A senior MP is under police investigation. You're not seriously suggesting that the media should just draw a veil over it and not talk about it. But it is worth recording while the media is getting a thrashing on this that we didn't name Mr. Hughes, he named himself. We didn't name the complainant even before the injunction was issued. We acted responsibly in that regard, I think.
Do you happen to know of details in this case which people have wanted to report but have withheld, either because it would undermine the investigation or perhaps just that it would simply be unethical?
Well, certainly. I mean, we withheld name and details of the complainant right from the start, which we had, because of that, really. Someone involved in an allegation of some sexual impropriety deserves to have the anonymity preserved, I guess.
Finally, Vernon, if you were to look at the reporting of the story to this point, if there were to be any kind of formal complaints to authorities such as the Broadcasting Standards Authority or the Press Council or any kind of ethical investigation somehow by other means, that there would be no reporting, nothing published or broadcast that you'd be aware of that you think would be a breach of basic standards of fairness, accuracy, balance or ethical behaviour?
Not that I'm aware of and that I could stand up, no.
That was Vernon Small, the Deputy Bureau Chief in the Parliamentary Press Gallery for Fairfax Media, talking to me there about criticism of the news media's reporting of former MP Darren Hughes in the week that the police stated that charges won't now follow from a complaint that was made against him back in March. Now, what happened to Darren Hughes is obviously a heavy political story, but as Jeremy Rose now reports, politicians and the media often combine to produce stuff that's far more lightweight too.
Kia ora, good evening. If ever there was evidence that politics and sport don't mix, it came this afternoon. The Labour MP for Dunedin South, Claire Curran, was thrown out of Parliament's debating chamber for wearing a Highlanders rugby jersey.
That was Hilary Barry introducing 3 News last Tuesday night, and TV3 was far from alone in judging that to be the most important political story of the day. It was a classic case of what former Australian Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner has labelled the sideshow syndrome in his recently published book, Sideshow, Dumbing Down Democracy. And Lindsay Tanner argues in that book that an increasing focus on the superficial over substance is seeing politicians adapting their behaviour to such an extent that the contest of ideas is being supplanted by the contest for laughs.
Peter Dunn, what can I say? Regular viewers may have noticed he isn't often on the show. In fact, we've arguably had more interviews with Elvis. But today, most unexpectedly, the United Future MP and leader for Ohariu in Wellington revealed... Sorry, and MP for Ohariu in Wellington revealed he had a sense of humour.
That was John Campbell introducing Campbell Live's first interview with United Future leader Peter Dunn in 6 years. The long-time revenue minister scored that rare interview after responding to media criticism of his wooden performance in his little-watched YouTube video blog, with a spoof episode making fun of both his own and John Campbell's hair. And then, possibly as a result of seeing just how much publicity laughing at himself generated, last week saw Peter Dunn accept this offer.
Peter Dunn, to loafer Peter.
To loafer Wallace. To loafer everyone.
To loafer everyone. And you've, Peter, you've also got some fans. A fan said, "Dear Peter, it would make my year if Peter Dunn planked on top of the backbenchers table." Come on.
That was Wallace Chapman of TVNZ7's Backbenchers programme encouraging United Future leader Peter Dunn to plank on live television. In news that the revenue minister had joined the fad that sees people lying rigid and in incongruous places was not only picked up by New Zealand's daily newspapers and serious political programmes like Television New Zealand's Q&A, it was widely reported by the Australian media. And none of that would have surprised Lindsay Tanner. In the introduction to his book, Sideshow, Dumbing Down Democracy, Lindsay Tanner predicted most journalists would simply skim-read the book for salacious gossip. And as the ABC's Media Watch programme reported, that prediction was pretty much spot on, with the Sunday Telegraph's editorial claiming,
"Tanner dumps on PM. Lindsay Tanner has poleaxed Ms Gillard. He takes veiled digs at ex-colleagues in the guise of a critique of shallow media coverage. Julia Gillard dyes her hair red. Queensland Premier Anna Bligh has Botox. Kevin Rudd once nibbled his own earwax. Mark Latham had man boobs."
Here's what Lindsay Tanner actually wrote. You'll find it at the bottom of page 21.
"Journalists like to pick up on something about a politician's clothes, physical appearance, language or demeanour. Julia Gillard's earlobes, Kevin Rudd's earwax, Anna Bligh's Botox and Mark Latham's man boobs have all received extensive media coverage."
That was the ABC's Media Watch, illustrating just how inaccurate, shoddy and shallow some political reporting is. But is there really anything new in the media treating news as a source of entertainment? It's a question I put to Lindsay Tanner.
It's certainly true that there's nothing new here. In fact, entertainment and theatre has been part of politics since ancient Greece. My argument is that it's got a lot worse, particularly over the past decade or so. And up to a point, I think it's a good thing. I think if you can make the presentation of politics a little bit mixed, a little bit of light and shade and some humour and some personality, that actually helps a wider range of people in the population to kind of access what's going on. But what's now happening is that it's kind of taken over, so that the serious content, the core material that is ultimately what democracy is supposed to be facing, which is the decisions that are being made, what their implications are, who stands for what politician represents what set of views, what positions, those things are kind of fading off the screen.
And you're saying that not only do the journalists behave this way, but the politicians, as a result of the way they're being reported, have become more superficial and are in fact behaving in a way which has the next night's news as its main focus rather than the good of the country or long-term policy.
Oh, absolutely. That kind of thinking that the 6 o'clock news is everything and that decisions about specific proposals or policy initiatives are basically shaped by media presentation considerations rather than the content of the issue or the nature of the problem, that has just got completely out of control. We've seen the emergence in Australia, and it's possibly the same in New Zealand and other parts of the world, of this new noun, announceable. An announceable is something that has one particularly important characteristic. It will get media coverage, preferably on page 3 of the major tabloids or something like that. The question of whether it actually has any merit is at best marginal. What you are seeking to do with an announceable is demonstrate that you're doing something. And much of the time, these announceables are actually just rubbish and in some cases outright counterproductive.
As a journalist reading your book, you know, there's lots of stuff which I agree with and you can't help but recognise. But there is the kind of chicken and egg question that comes up for me, is how much of this can we lay at the feet of the media and how much of it is actually politicians who have been feeding this type of coverage because it suits them as well as it suits the profit-driven newspapers and television shows?
Look, I think it's impossible to answer that question. And in a sense, my argument in the book, of course, is, look, there are no bad guys as such here. I'm trying to point out to people that the problems that you are unhappy with, like spin and politicians talking from scripts and never answering the question, these are things that are not just caused by politicians. In fact, they are primarily driven by defensive reactions by politicians to the way media treats politics, but attributing proportionate blame, I think, is just impossible. And, of course, the community shouldn't get off scot-free either, because one of the things that the head of one of the main commercial TV networks said to me years ago when I criticised their program A Current Affair, which is basically a freak show, he said, look, every time we put a politician on A Current Affair, 100,000 viewers change the channel. So there is a complex thing happening here where public demand, which I think is influenced by a very complacent mood in the Australian community at the moment, interacts with both the behaviour of politicians and the behaviour of the media, and of course the media and the politicians interact with each other. So what I'm trying to do with this book is say, look, the media are major players here. Their behaviour has changed, primarily because of commercial pressures, and the politicians are, to a large degree, responding to those pressures. But it's impossible to kind of unravel the whole thing and say, well, you know, mostly it's the media or mostly it's politicians.
Well, we're seeing this bizarre kind of blurring of the boundaries, aren't we? In New Zealand, we've just had a series that's finished called Make the Politician Work, where you've put politicians into these situations where they have to pretend to be workers and see what it's like. I understand the opposite happened with you guys, with politicians being told to go out and work as a kind of publicity stunt.
Exactly. Like, I don't know the show that you've referred to, so I should be careful about commenting on it. But frankly, this stuff is just rubbish. You know, it is infantile rubbish. The different politicians have different life experiences. In fact, it is a problem that we're getting less life experience. But you know, the notion that if you spend 24 hours pretending to be a hospital cleaner or something, that this actually delivers anything of any great value to the governance of the nation is frankly ridiculous. it is just all about entertainment, and it's about politicians pretending.
In New Zealand, I'm sure in Australia, we can actually watch politicians at work. We've got Parliament on TV. We've also got shows where politicians get put on the spot and, you know, long-form interviews. They simply don't attract the audience. You know, so the one time when lots of people see these politicians is where they go on a reality TV program.
Oh, precisely, and that is at the very heart of the problem, and that's why they do it. Because the media perform two functions, informing and entertaining. Virtually everybody wants to be entertained, but only a proportion of people, sometimes only a modest minority, want to be informed. And therefore, because name recognition is at the heart of politics, in a world where ideological divisions have basically vanished or melted away to a great degree, in a world where the intermediate organisations that used to help transmit political messages to a wider audience, like service clubs, trade unions, churches, where their influence has dramatically diminished. Basically, the only way that politicians have got to communicate to a big proportion of their mass audience is by essentially going on entertainment shows. They also try and get celebrity guest stints at sporting events. They make sure that they attend significant funerals, which will get on the 6 o'clock news. The reason they're doing it is because if they don't, half the population don't even know they exist. I think all players can lift their game here. Politicians in the way they communicate, the media in the way that it seems to assume that there are only two choices here, either dead boring and serious on the one hand that nobody will watch, or on the other hand, fluffy entertainment with no content that lots of people will watch. There are intermediate options in the middle.
Well, let's look at, you know, some of those different options and start with the politicians themselves. I mean, you describe politicians setting up endless photo opportunities, and there's been the Media Watch program in Australia highlighted some very funny ones with Brendan O'Connor setting up a raid on a fishing boat and even having an actor pretending to be a foreigner with a, you know, terrible foreign accent. When you were a politician, no doubt you did similar things. What is the role of a politician? How would you now say the politicians should contribute to a more adult, more sensible politics? Should you simply refuse to take part in those photo ops?
I think you need to sort of unpack this question and almost go through the list of various things. Like, there are certain factors in play here which make it very difficult for an individual politician to unilaterally just say, well, I'm not playing this game, because in effect that amounts to saying I'm not going to compete, my career is over. In the same way that if you're a footballer and the rules change and you don't like a new rule, you'll suffer the consequences and your career will probably be over. So there is enormous pressure just by the reality of the situation for people to conform, and they do.
There's also enormous public goodwill when a sportsman actually plays by the rules and does the honourable thing, though.
No, I'm actually talking about the opposite, where if you change the rules and say the following behaviour is now outlawed and a free kick will be given against you, or if you do it, even if you think it's a crazy rule, guess what? You adhere to the rule, because to break the rule just means you get free kicked all the time, and end result, you no longer play. To some degree, the artificial set piece event is unavoidable. You know, doorstop interviews, things like that, impromptu press conferences. I don't think there's much wrong with them, even though they have an artificial quality to them. So, yes, I think politicians as a class can do quite a lot better.
What about things like when you were an opposition MP, you helped bring down the career of Peter Reith, a minister in the Howard government, by feeding information to the media about the telecom card scandal, so-called. How do you feel about that in hindsight? I mean, is there too much energy by opposition MPs put into scandal rather than policy?
I think at various times that's probably true, but in part, I think, is a feature of the kind of adversarial system that we have both in Australia and New Zealand and in many parts of the world, where the capacity for the opposition to be significant players in actual policy decisions is very, very limited. And so you find yourself in opposition a lot of the time, basically being very frustrated. If you're in opposition, your aim is to win. And in order to win, you need to maximise your media coverage. And you're faced with a choice. You run hard on a particular scandal, or you have a really worthy, important policy idea to pursue, and the media will give you lots of coverage on the scandal and none on the worthy policy idea. What do? You run with the scandal. So the circumstances kind of conspire to more or less require you to run hard on the thing that's going to get a lot of coverage.
And what about the other players in it? You've got, you know, quite a strong public broadcasting media in Australia. How much have they been influenced by this? Because they obviously don't have the same commercial pressures, but do they fall into the same traps?
They certainly have been influenced by it. Only last night we had an unbelievably lengthy item on the ABC News about a minister in the state government, in the Victorian government, missing a vote on a very inconsequential thing because she was asleep in her office at 11 o'clock at night. They had about four or five different people being interviewed, and it was a very lengthy item, relatively high up in the news. You know, this is a complete joke. This is a totally inconsequential story. The opposition have presented her with an alarm clock. That got a mention. We are very fortunate to have the ABC and SBS. The ABC has been influenced by this trend a bit, but it is much, much better than the alternatives.
That was the former Australian Cabinet Minister Lindsay Tanner, author of the recently published book Sideshow, which is promoted as an account of the relentless decline of political reporting and political behaviour which occurred during his career. And there he was talking to Media Watch's Jeremy Rose. Last weekend here on Media Watch, we looked at two stories which had featured the previous week, both on TV3's current affairs programmes and in the magazine Woman's Day. One was the story of Sharon Armstrong, a New Zealander held in prison in Argentina, who's now facing drug trafficking charges, and the other, the story of the so-called Facebook predator Natalia Burgess, who's been in the news for tricking several young men using phony identities she created on the internet. And in the case of Woman's Day's feature on Natalia Burgess, Media Watch was wrong to say that she appeared in the magazine all dolled up in nice new dresses. The clothes were in fact her own, and the hairdo and makeup we referred to last week is standard for interviewees being photographed for a feature in the magazine and not any kind of special treatment. And we also neglected to mention last weekend that Woman's Day's article on Natalia Burgess also included interviews with several people who suffered as a result of her behaviour, and that gave the article a rather different tone to that described on Media Watch last weekend. Another issue we also raised last week was the confusing claims that some stories were exclusive, even though other newspapers had carried earlier reports and interviews featuring the same people. And since then, TV3's been in touch to point out that in fact they only ever claimed their interview with Sharon Armstrong on Campbell Live was a television exclusive. And as that was the first formal face-to-face interview with Sharon Armstrong and was secured after complicated negotiations with authorities in Argentina, that was a fair enough claim. And of course, you too can get in touch and tell us what you think about what you've heard in Media Watch. You can send us an email, mediawatch@radionz.co.nz is the address, or you can write a letter to us, Media Watch, P.O. Box 123 Wellington is the postal address. And roughly once a month, we run through the queries and comments we've received to make our online-only companion to Media Watch, Media Watch Extra. And we'll let you know here on Media Watch when the next edition of that is available for you on the Radio New Zealand website. radionz.co.nz. And finally on Media Watch this week, last Wednesday night, Murray Deeker opened his weekly TV show on Sky Sports like this.
Good evening. Last week on this program, I used an outdated phrase to describe something that had happened way back in time. It was appropriate then, but it is not appropriate in 2011, and I'm sorry.
And the reason Murray Deeker offered that somewhat economical apology was that he'd used a derogatory racial term on his show 7 days earlier, one that few broadcasters allow their staff to use on the air, and the one that came second when the Broadcasting Standards Authority last surveyed public opinion on which words aren't acceptable on the air. Reporting on the controversy that's followed, some newspapers have referred to that word as the N-bomb, or simply printed it as N with five following asterisks, but others have used the word in full, even in big bold front page headlines. Now, Deeker on Sport is a discussion show on a pay TV sports channel, and as such, only a small audience would have actually seen the broadcast that night. But one viewer who recorded it then posted a video of it online, and thousands more people since then have seen it after TVNZ embedded that viewer's video in an online news story on its news website.
There was a guy who was a sheep farmer in central Otago, and somebody asked him why he was running the biggest sheep farm, and he was working like a n**** at the time. He was just throwing things out and just absolutely ripping into it. Mm.
Now, initially, that comment passed off without much comment. It was only 2 days later that it hit the front page of several papers, with some of the headlines calling it a slur, even though it was actually a compliment, albeit one that included a derogatory and racist word. And while there's nothing new about the papers making a big deal out of any controversial behaviour by broadcasters, in this case, it was news reports of the reaction to the comment which gave the story legs. Sky's spokesman Tony O'Brien, for example, was quoted as saying that the network had not received any complaints about it, and while he didn't defend or condone Murray Deeker's choice of words, it was, he said, a widely used phrase. Well, after that, the company's corporate communications manager was reported as saying that wasn't what he meant, and he would have gone on to say that it was a once widely used phrase. Well, the following day, Murray Deeker himself made a statement apologising from the Rarotongan resort where he was taking a break, and Michael Laws told the Herald that Murray Deeker was being attacked by politically correct Nazis, though in fact only Race Relations Commissioner Joris de Bres had appeared in the news with any criticism, and he was condemning the language rather than the broadcaster himself. However, the hosts of Radio Live's afternoon sports show did seem concerned about the incident, and earlier in the day, before Murray Deeker had issued his apology, they decided to go to the man at the very top of Sky TV about all this.
Yeah, and a real privilege for us to have John Follett, the boss of Sky, on the line with us. You talk to anyone that works out at Sky, he's a man with real integrity. A lot of his staff talk about John Follett as a man of honour and someone who have they have a lot of respect for. So it's disappointing, I guess, that we have to talk to Mr. Follett about this particular issue.
Well, Sky's boss, John Follett, then told Radio Live's John Matheson Murray Deeker was no racist as far as he was concerned. But not satisfied with that, John Matheson pressed the Sky TV boss harder about comments in the media made by others, including Murray Deeker's on-air colleague at the radio network News Talk ZB, Willie Losay.
He's quoted today saying, quote, "He says it all the time. I just never thought he'd say it on air." Two things here. I guess, you're saying you've never heard Murray Deeker use the N-word?
Never. I mean, Willie does not work with Murray at Sky. He works with the ones at B, so I think it's a different, I'll be happy to take responsibility what happens in Sky's world, but not on Radio Sport.
No, but he said this word on your channel, hasn't he?
That's right.
So what's your message to the people at Sky about the use of this word?
I don't know how many times I can say it. It's unacceptable.
Now, that you'd think could be the end of the matter, but John Matheson continued to press John Follett about the ethnic composition of Sky TV's workforce, whether he'd now lay down a warning for Sky's staff about appropriate language, whether he approved of his spokesman's reported comments earlier, and whether he'd now be meeting with Murray Deeker to clear the air. Well, that interview ended after 12 grueling minutes in total, but John Matheson and his co-host Hamish Mackay still weren't done. They chewed over the issues for a few minutes more between themselves. And eventually, the concerned host John Matheson wound things up with this comment about the broadcaster, who's also, of course, the main man in sport at Radio Live's big commercial rival, News Talk ZB.
It's front page news of the New Zealand Herald today. It'll be in the Sunday papers tomorrow for sure, and Sky TV, the host broadcaster of the Rugby World Cup. And guess who's in town at the moment? The IRB. Mm. And you've got a guy, Murray Deeker, who's very, very high profile on Sky, using the N-word. Not a good look.
Now, not yet convinced that they'd done and said enough here, co-host Hamish Mackay then said that Radio Live's listeners would soon have to hear it all over again.
I think we probably should hear
your interview again, Matho, maybe after five with John Follett, the CEO of Sky.
Yet before they were able to repeat that interview, they ran this mocking intro in the following hour of their programme, which repeated the very slur from Murray Deeker's show the previous week that they'd seemed so concerned about in the first place.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your host, Murray Deeker.
You know, there was a guy who was a sheep farmer in Central Otago. Somebody asked him why he was running the biggest sheep farm. And he was working like a m**t at the time. He was just throwing things.
Now, appropriately there, they bleeped out Murray Deeker's inflammatory word, but still, that probably left their listeners confused about whether this was really supposed to be a hanging offence or a laughing matter. Well, that's all we have for you in the programme this week, but we'll be back again with plenty more on the media next week. So join the Media Watch team again at the same time next Sunday here on Radio New Zealand National.